Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You promise that this year you're going to have better habits at work. You're going to stop procrastinating. You're going to get disciplined about maybe looking for a better job or maybe even something personal like losing weight. But you're afraid that as with your past New Year's resolutions, before this month is over, those resolutions will have become just another failure on the highway of your goals past. Well, with me to offer a basis for realistic optimism that this year will finally be different is Charles Duhigg. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times staff writer and author of a book that has just spent 60 weeks on the New York Times national bestseller list. The book is The Power of Habit: Why We Do What We Do in Life and in Business, just out by Random House and paperback. Charles Duhigg, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It is my pleasure indeed. I would think after having done umpteen or probably more than probably scores of interviews at this point, they may become a little redundant, but hopefully it will be a fresh even for you. We'll find out.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love talking about this, and because it's time for New Year's resolutions, it's a great time of year to be talking about it.
Indeed. Random House was brilliant in coming out with a paperback right in January.
It's true. It wasn't completely accidental.
Yes, I wouldn't have thought so, yes. And anyway, I'm not going to be able to resist asking you about how to lose weight. It's a personal issue of mine, but this program is about work, so we need to focus there. Now, some of my career counseling clients, they really lament that they really have terrible discipline around work. They don't look for a job with the diligence they know they should. On the job, they do the least they can get away with rather than trying to be as productive as they can. Or maybe unconsciously, they simply procrastinate nearly every distasteful task. So it's no surprise that those folks, some of them at least, are unemployed. Do you have any advice about how they can develop a different habit around their work ethic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there's a huge amount of research on procrastination and work habits. It's one of the most kind of heavily studied and most interesting topics. And a lot of what people have found is that people develop habits around procrastination. And the thing about a habit, as everyone who's listening knows, is that it's so powerful because in some respects it happens automatically with your brain. Mm-hmm. Your brain kind of turns off when you're in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And this is what we've learned about how habits function from a neurological perspective. Every habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior to start. And then a routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, reward. And the reward is how your brain learns to sort of crave and practice that pattern in the future. And what's important is that if you have habits you want to change, you need to recognize what reward it's giving you, right? Take procrastination, for instance. Everyone procrastinates. Some people to more or less degrees. And the reason why is because it delivers us an almost immediate reward. When you're procrastinating and you start surfing the web and looking at, you know, fantasy football sites or TMZ, you're rewarding yourself with this kind of novelty, this break. And the key is that once that reward exists in your life, you can't extinguish it. You have to find ways to give it to yourself that are more productive. What that means for a lot of people is that if you have a productivity problem, a procrastination problem, what you should do is you should basically let yourself procrastinate in very measured doses at certain times. So one of the best strategies is basically to say, work for the next 15 minutes and then give yourself 10 minutes to surf the web and use a timer to actually keep track of these things. Hmm. And what you'll find is that gradually your brain kind of learns to let yourself do more and more work.
So implicit in that is that you shouldn't fight against your basic instinct, that you should accept that you're a procrastinator and merely set up some external structure that's going to enable you to, without requiring a personality transplant, slowly inexorably change. Is that fair?
That's exactly right. And it's not that someone's a procrastinator or not a procrastinator. It's that people need some type of stimulation. We get bored or we get distracted. And the key is to channel that into times when it's appropriate. So it's not procrastination. It's giving yourself a break.
Yeah, indeed. I had heard it. They called a variation of this called the Pomodoro technique because there were these timers that were in the shape of a tomato. And they're little, very small, and they're very compact, and they're very cheap. And the notion was that you would set the timer for 20 minutes, and you would work for 20 minutes. Then you would get 10 minutes off, another 20 minutes on, and then 10 minutes off, and then 20 minutes on and 30 minutes off, so that there was a, you know, there was an additional bigger reward at the end of 1 hour. That sounds like just a variation of what you're talking about. I want to give our listeners, as you know, a buffet of options other than using the, you know, 10 minutes on, 20 minutes on, 15 minutes on, 10 minutes off technique. Is there another way to use that cue, that cue routine reward triad to overcome procrastination or other bad work habits?
Absolutely. I mean, an important part of it is to actually structure rewards that you actually enjoy. So, for instance, one thing that's very effective is to write out a list of, you know, what's your goals for today? And just come up with two or three of them. And when you accomplish that goal, give yourself some reward that you actually enjoy and let yourself enjoy it. One of the problems is that very frequently, particularly people who are kind of like, you're either out of work or you're struggling because like you're trying to get some project done, there's this instinct not to let yourself enjoy rewards. And so people will, you know, accomplish something and then they'll jump right into the next task, or they'll say, okay, now I can take, you know, a walk around the block, but I'm going to hurry through the walk. Your neurology, your brain only latches on to behaviors when the reward is actually a reward. So if you just got some big memo done, give yourself 20 minutes to like surf the web or go, you know, have a snack or something like that, and let yourself actually enjoy it, so that your brain learns, this is a pattern I want to remember for the future.
You're emphasizing the reward. Most of the literature about behavior change talks about the value of two kinds of extrinsic rewards. There is the reward, but then there's a punishment. And the most potent of the extrinsic reward schemes normally have both rewards and punishments. I note the absence of punishment or penalties in your equation. Is that deliberate?
Well, not really. I mean, so penalties have its place, and they should be paired. What we've learned, though, is that rewards, positive rewards, are much more powerful than negative rewards. And so it's important to focus, first of all, on positive rewards. Now, that being said, negative rewards also have their place. So another strategy for instance, dealing with procrastination is, and I've talked to people who have used this, is to take a check, your checkbook,
right.
Write a check for $100 to some cause you hate. One that's often used is actually the American Nazi Party.
Right.
No one wants to give money to the American Nazi Party.
Right.
And put it in an envelope, address it, and then if you don't hit a goal by a certain time, if you fall off the wagon, if you procrastinate for 45 minutes one day in a row, then just stick that check in the mail. And I promise, putting that check on your desk, knowing that you're going to fund something that you hate, that's going to help reinforce that you really need to buckle down and do the thing that you want to do. So negative rewards have their place. The issue is that they really have to be used in tandem with positive rewards. People tend to focus on one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to have a positive reward to also offset or complement the negative reward.
Now, there is normally a triad. There is the reward, there is the penalty, but there is perhaps more central and more important is the intrinsic motivation. I've generally found that without regard to rewards or punishment, there are some people who will work to be as productive as they possibly can be because intrinsically, almost from a cosmic perspective, it feels like the right way to live. If not simply just an ethical thing to do because your boss is paying you for 10 hours, you should pay, you know, work for 10 hours. What are your thoughts about the relative roles of the intrinsic motivation versus the extrinsics like rewards and punishments?
That's a great question, because one of the things that we've learned is that extrinsic rewards, like, for instance, giving yourself 10 minutes on the internet or, you know, having a snack, those always become less valuable to your brain over time.
Right.
Basically, extrinsic rewards lose novelty value over time, and so they become less rewarding. Whereas intrinsic rewards, a sense of pride or a sense of accomplishment, those remain very, very fresh over time. They don't essentially kind of tap out. And so the key is to move every single habit from an extrinsic reward to an intrinsic reward. And the way that you do that is essentially you just practice at it. By patting yourself on the back and giving yourself 10 minutes on the internet or a nice long shower after a run or, you know, a piece of chocolate or something like that, that extrinsic reward will essentially put you in a mindset where you begin developing intrinsic rewards, a sense of pride and accomplishment, satiation from the activity. And it's important to develop those, but the key is it's really just a product of time. You just have to do it for a little while and let yourself enjoy the reward and really reflect on why you're actually doing this, which is probably intrinsic reasons.
You're saying that the temporal, the time sequence should be extrinsic first, which then yields to intrinsic. I wonder whether it should be the opposite. Whether, and it's not merely I wonder, it's something I practice in my career counseling practice all the time. I like to start with the intrinsic. If you believe that it is a cosmic good to be working at being as productive as possible, then the rewards will have more potency. Although, you know, when you're doing the extrinsic rewards and punishments, you're treating the symptom. You're treating the lack of an intrinsic drive, an intrinsic motivation. So better to start by trying to get to the root issue, which is to get somebody to, without needing any rewards and punishments, work hard because it's either cosmically feels right or ethically feels right. And then, as needed, to bolster the intrinsic motivation's lack, you know, the lack of intrinsic motivation, if it's not, nobody's fully driven like that, then you add the extrinsic rewards and punishments. Do you buy my sequence?
Sure, if that works for you. I mean, I think that the thing is that most people, and we know this from neurological studies, they have a very difficult time intellectualizing themselves into seeing something as a rewarding experience. So even if I tell you, like, you're making the world a better place or you're achieving your goals by working a full day, people tend to not emotionally experience that, even if they've intellectually had the even if intellectually they believe that there should be a reward there. Now, that being said, one of the nice things about humans is that things become rewarding because we decide they're rewarding. Mm-hmm. This is actually one of the biggest things that sets us apart from sort of other animals. And so I think that what you're saying in essence is, you know, remind yourself why you're doing what you're doing, that you should feel good, that there's a virtue to what you're doing. And over time, absolutely reminding yourself of that and letting yourself sort of experience that positiveness, that will actually cause your brain to react as if it is a reward, and it will become a reward in and of itself.
Implicit in what you say is very interesting. It may be that thinking cosmically is simply too cosmic for most mortals, and so there can be a hierarchy, if you will. There was this guy, Lawrence Kohlberg, who was a famous moral theorist many years ago, and he posited a six stages of why people are motivated. Some people are motivated at the most basic level for fear they're going to get killed or get hurt or get fired. Then there are others who, you know, are motivated because it's a rule and they want to follow the rule. That's the next highest level. The third highest level is that it's an ethical responsibility. Fourth highest level is that it's a societal obligation. And fifth is this kind of cosmic universal thing. So depending upon who you are, maybe your intrinsic motivation will simply come from a more basic level, like, well, it's the rule that I'm supposed to work 8 hours, and maybe that's a useful buffet to keep in mind as you try to develop your intrinsic motivation. What do you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think you're exactly right, that different people have different motivations, and so finding your motivation is important, but at the root, it's sort of all the same thing, which is find some reward that genuinely feels rewarding, and then let yourself enjoy it. Too frequently, we do the opposite. You know, one of my favorite examples is actually exercise, right? When you think about how most people exercise, they'll wake up in the morning, they'll go for a run for the first time, and then they get home and they're like running late, and they're anxious about getting to work, and they got to get the kids ready for school, and so the whole morning becomes kind of chaos. They're kind of punishing themselves for going running, right? And your brain latches on to that. Mm-hmm. So when you when there's a behavior that you want to make into a habit, a pattern, give yourself a reward you genuinely enjoy, whether it be a sense of pride or whether it be something external, and then let yourself actually enjoy it.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Charles Duhigg. He is the author of the true, you know, the word bestseller is thrown around too easily, but it really was for 60 weeks on the top or near the top of the New York, on the New York Times bestseller list. The book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and in Business. It's now available in paperback, so you can save a few bucks. And now I'd like to turn to you, my dear listeners. If you have a habit, especially related to work, that now here we are in 2014 and you justifiably are scared that your New Year's resolution to be harder working or learn that computer skill or whatever is just going to be another empty promise that will give way by the end of the week, maybe you can get some realistic help from a guy who's quite expert at this. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, I guess I can't resist. I'm going to tell you about my own weight problems, try to apply this to that. Unfortunately, even in the workplace, lookism is rampant. And if you are overweight, that is going to be viewed as a sign of sloth. And so I can even tie my weight loss issue to work. So here's the deal. I work a lot, and I value work a lot, but it's not because it's pleasurable, because it feels like the right way to live one's life. And one of the few rewards, maybe my greatest reward that is pure and unadulterated pleasure, is eating. And unfortunately, I have a tendency to gain weight. And so in order for me to not gain weight, I have to be good roughly 95% of the meals. But what happens is, even though I go and I realize I can substitute a reward that isn't calorific, like walking my doggie, whom I love dearly, and not even rushing at it or whatever, in the end, I'm not good enough, often enough, to break my habit of eating, even though I'm telling myself, I've written articles on the keys to losing weight. I am well aware of the importance of vigilance, of only eating until you're no longer full, rather than until you're stuffed. And yet I am 20 pounds overweight. Any advice on how I can break that habit?
So it's really, and there's a huge amount of research, as you know, on eating habits and how we can achieve weight loss. You know, I mean, I think the most important thing is, it sounds like for you that food provides a really, really salient reward, a reward that you enjoy a lot.
Yeah, especially unless it's carrots or celery.
Unless it's calories or celery, right. Mm-hmm. My guess is that there's certain types of reward, certain types of foods that provide that reward much, much faster.
Like cheese, yeah.
Or probably, I'm going to conjecture here, maybe things that are high in protein, like make you feel full faster. This is kind of one of the tenets of why, for instance, low-carb diets seem to work, is because people seem to feel faster, feel full much faster. Does that work for you?
I love cheese, Indian buffets, anything with carbs. I'm a carb lover, actually.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because people who are carb lovers, they tend to get a sense of satiation from carbs. And neurochemically, we can see this, right, happen in people's brains, that when they eat carbs, it sets off a cascade of sort of neurotransmitters that makes them feel kind of comfortable and full. Many of those same people can get that same sense from other foods, particularly very high-protein foods. And so as a result, I would say the number one thing to do is not to try and say, like, I'm going to eliminate this type of reward from my life. It's to say, how can I get this reward in a better way? How can I get this reward in a lower calorie way? How can I get this reward from some other behavior that seems to provide a similar sense of satiation? There's many people who, for instance, eat because it provides a physical sense of comfort, and there's been studies that have shown that those people can also get a similar sense of comfort from, like, taking a nice warm shower, and that actually taking a warm shower will, in fact, make you less hungry for some people. The key is to just look at it as baby steps. I mean, nobody's able to change their diet overnight. What they're able to do is they're able to basically say, I'm going to put off having that plate of pasta for 15 minutes, and they're going to set a timer. And maybe at the end of the 15 minutes, they need that plate of pasta. But maybe they learn something about how they can distract themselves from needing that sense of comfort or avoiding that craving. Yeah. It's a matter of doing experiments with yourself and figuring out what actually makes the difference.
Dear listeners, I'll now give out the phone number. If you would like to get some advice on how you can change your habit, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for a question for Charles Duhigg, the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Sometimes you're not trying to change your own habits, but you're trying to change somebody else. And again, focusing the show on work, let's say you are a supervisor or a manager or a leader. You write in your book about Paul O'Neill at Alcoa, and he wanted to change his employees' attitudes towards safety. Tell us what the situation was at Alcoa and how Paul got his employees to develop a new habit.
Well, it was really interesting. When Paul O'Neill took over Alcoa, and most people probably know Paul O'Neill as the former Treasury Secretary, but
right.
The reason he got that job was because he was so successful as the CEO of Alcoa, the largest aluminum manufacturer in the world. And when he took the job, the company was really divided, right? Management and workers sort of saw themselves as enemies. And Paul came in, and instead of focusing on profits or on, you know, the sort of efficiency or productivity. What he said was he was going to make his number one goal to change worker safety habits. And the reason why is because it was something everyone could agree on. Workers care about worker safety because they don't want to feel unsafe going to work. Managers cared about it because accidents would cut into productivity. And so he found this common ground everyone could talk about. And then what he did is he actually built a habit within Alcoa that only rewarded people who took worker safety seriously. So he basically instituted this rule that anytime there was an accident, and accidents would happen all the time, within 24 hours, the manager had to send him a memo explaining exactly what had happened and why it would never happen again. And that the only people who would get promoted are the people who could send these memos and bring down their accident rate. Well, of course, it turns out that if you're going to write a memo in 24 hours, you actually have to change all your communication habits, right? Because you have to start figuring out what's going on the floor much faster so you're aware of an accident when it happens and find people who have good ideas for improvements. But the key was that he was able to find some type of emotion that touched on that touched people's lives emotionally. And because this habit had an emotional component, it was something that set off a chain reaction and changed the culture within Alcoa. And this is really important. Habits that have emotions are what are known as keystone habits, and they're very, very powerful.
Absolutely, Will. And also, of course, he had imposed both, his paradigm was both reward and punishment. No manager wants to have to write a memo, whether in 24 hours or 48 hours, explaining what happened. And that just simply, that fear of having to do that, probably made that manager take some various efforts to impose the rules or procedures that would have reduced accidents. So there was the punishment, and the reward, of course, was, the promotions.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that made a huge, huge difference to sort of have this balance going on there.
I want to talk about that keystone. It's very important. It really does seem like, you know, when I look historically at the people who have overcome serious procrastination habits, laziness habits, whatever, there is usually an emotional trigger. They found a romantic partner that they cared enough about that they were willing to be responsible about their work. They had a child. Their parent got a serious illness. The emotional component is critical. Tell us more from your perspective about this notion of the keystone issue and the emotional factors that lead to motivating people to create a new habit.
Well, you're exactly right. It corresponds with what you just said, which is that within psychology, there's these habits known as keystone habits, because it seems like when they start to change, they set off this chain reaction that make other habits more flexible. A great example, actually, of this is exercise. People who start exercising habitually, they start eating more healthily without even really thinking about it. And that makes sense, right? Because you're feeling good about your body. It's easier to skip the hamburger at lunch. What's interesting is that people, on average, who start exercising habitually, they also start using their credit cards less. They procrastinate less during the day. They do their dishes earlier in the day. And what's happening there, and of course nobody goes for a run and thinks, oh, this is going to help me keep my Amex in my pocket.
Right.
What's happening, though, is that for many people, exercise has an emotional component. When you start exercising habitually, you start thinking of yourself as someone who has this willpower to exercise. And that influences all these other small choices you make without you even really being aware of it. And it's because it changes your self-image, because there's an emotional component of exercise for many people, that they start to feel pride of themselves, that I'm the type of person who can wake up in the morning and go exercising.
Well, Charge, what you're saying is just one more example that proves to me how anomalous I am, because I exercise like a fiend. And what happens as a result is, because of the exercise, first of all, I'm more hungry because I've used up more calories, and so I'm more hungry, and I feel entitled. And in fact, that does comport with some medical research that finds that that exercise has no impact on weight loss at all, because whatever calories you may burn in a half hour, 400, 500 calories, you know, that often gets compensated by the increased appetite and sense of entitlement. Does that make sense?
Well, for you, exercise might not be a keystone habit. You know, keystone habits differ from person to person and company to company. And the key is that it usually, a keystone habit exists when it tends to change your self-image.
Mm, good point.
Right? So if you're doing something that seems kind of frightening to you, if something that seems like almost irrationally like scary to start,
like what?
That suggests that there's some type of emotional element there and that it might be a keystone habit for you. So for many people, it's exercise. Like if you talk to many people who don't exercise, they'll actually say, like, I'm kind of scared to start running tomorrow because I don't have the right clothes. I'm going to look like an idiot. For other people, it's things like public speaking, or it's, you know, sort of taking on some new project at work. The key is to look for these habits that sort of seem irrationally scary, and that would suggest that that is a habit, that if you change, it'll set off a chain reaction in your life and change other patterns in ways that you're not even anticipating.
Okay, so let me give you the phone number one more time. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco. If you've got a habit, you or someone you love's got a habit that you'd like to change, I'm talking with Charles Duhigg, Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the things that people procrastinate, you were implying implicit in what you just said, people may not procrastinate lots of small tasks, but if they've got a big mountain of a task, a big project, a big report, a big speech, or whatever, they will procrastinate. And, you know, in the end, yeah, you can tell them all day and all night to break it down to baby steps, but it ain't going to work. Can you apply some of your methodology to that specific example of where you've got a mountain of a project facing you?
There's a huge amount of research involving exactly why it's so hard to start these big tasks. And a lot of it involves the limbic system of our brain, which is essentially an emotional register of our brain, that things that seem kind of scary because they're so big will set off this limbic reaction, mm-hmm. which will make us crave some type of short-term reward instead of a long-term reward. Mm-hmm. And so the key there is very often to, like you said, break it into baby steps, but then change it into actions. Right? Instead of writing down, my goal tomorrow is to, you know, learn everything I can about the oil industry, break it down into three very specific, very short-term, very easy-to-accomplish actions. And what that does is it actually bypasses some of the emotional parts of our brains. It draws more on the logical, cognitive, prefrontal cortex. And as a result, we're usually able to overcome some of that anxiety that might be delaying us. So the number one thing to do is if you have a big project, just ignore the big project. Find three immediate steps that you can do that start that project. And everyone knows this. The second and the third step are much easier than the first step. It's just a matter of figuring out how to trick your brain into thinking of that first step as something small, easy, and precise and concrete about what you're supposed to do.
Yep, I call that the one-second task. Even if it's to turn on the computer, open the book, whatever, you know, one-second task is not intimidating at all. Start with the one-second task. Anyway, let's go to the phones.
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Charles Duhigg, the author of Power of Habit. What's your question or comment for him? Hi, it's your turn on the air. Hello? Are you there? Are you there?
I am here.
You are here. Great. Okay. What's your question or comment for Charles Duhigg?
Well, I want to thank you because I've been unemployed for 2 years, and I just realized that the one reason why I am fearful of sending my resumes is because I feel like I don't write well enough. And so thanks to you, I'm going to break my habit and I'm going to take a writing class just to break it and see if I can make it better.
Sounds good. One other thing, you know, not everything is a breaking a habit. You know, America has become the land of outsourcing. Not everything can never be an expert at everything. So is it possible that you need somebody to at least edit your work? So, you know, a course is a major undertaking. If you need to get a job, taking a course could take months. To become a good enough writer could take years. Is this something that rather you should write a draft so it really is in your own voice, but simply send it to somebody who is a native speaker of English to just tweak it a little bit?
Well, that's what's been happening. You know, I got a lot of support and a lot of people helping me out, and they finally get so frustrated with me because they don't see improvement, and although I see a huge improvement in my own writing, so you don't think a class will be?
I'm not sure it's time effective. With me, also, I wouldn't try to skirt my. You know, one of the smartest things to do in general in life is try to, instead of remediating your weaknesses, build on your strengths. So, if you are a crappy writer, one of the things you might want to do, but you're better on the phone or in person, maybe you want to make your inquiries by phone, not necessarily responding to an open ad where you have to write, but do some more networking, do some more phone calling, invite people for coffee, throw a party, whatever it is, because in these these times, especially if you've been unemployed a long time, it's very difficult for an unemployed person to get a job by answering an ad, because they get dozens, if not hundreds, of applications from people who are well-employed. And if you've been unemployed for a long time, they think there's a reason that all the employers have rejected you, or you've just have been very ill or whatever. So I would encourage you to perhaps, rather than even worrying about the writing component, try to land your first job after a long period of unemployment by networking. Does that make sense?
Yes, totally. And that was another thing that I wrote. I need to just get out of my couch and go and meet people.
In the way that's fun for you. What's the fun way for you to meet people?
Well, I'm going to go back into the clubs that I belonged before.
Good.
But I felt totally, totally incompetent and fearless because I didn't have a job. And I guess my self-confidence suffer immensely.
In this era and in this time and era where there are so many people who not so much were unemployed but underemployed, there is no shame to saying you're looking for a next... You don't have to frame it negatively. You can say, I'm looking for a better job than I've ever had before. Here are the things that I bring to the table. Here are the things I like to do. Might you know somebody I should talk with? There's no shame in that.
Well, thank you so much. Again, thanks for this incredible program and gift. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Charles, is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that's all great advice. And the other thing I would say, and it sounds like you're learning from this already, is failures usually aren't failures, right? If you send out some resumes and you don't hear anything back, if you go to a networking event and it doesn't feel like it was a really positive experience, that's not a failure. That's an experiment that you just ran, and you're learning something from it. You know, we know a lot about this from people who try and quit smoking. On average, people who give up cigarettes have tried to quit 7 times before they finally quit. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because oftentimes we need to learn from ourselves by conducting an experiment and then seeing where the experiment fails. And it's people who, when smokers try and quit and then they relapse and they learn something from that, that's when they finally figure out how to actually quit. And it sounds like you're going through this right now, and that just don't see like a bad experience as a failure. See it as just one step closer to learning what actually works.
Indeed, one of the major differentiators between successful and unsuccessful people is not that they fail, it's how they respond to failure. The term resilience is used all the time. If in fact, you know, not always can you learn a lesson from your failure, but the whether it be winning salespeople or winning executives or winning nonprofit leaders, generally it is how they respond, whether they get, you know, they curl up in bed with a joint, or they go and they say, what can I learn from this? How can I, you know, what can I do? How can I try again? That is a key differentiator, and I wish that for you. You won't succeed all the time, but I do wish you a lot of resilience, and I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you so much, and happy New Year to both of you. I appreciate it very
much. Thank you.
Take care. One more time, I'll give out the phone number. If you would like some advice about a habit you would like to inculcate in 2014, notwithstanding all the failures you've had at them in the past, we want to give you some realistic basis for hope. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, and my special guest, Charles Duhigg, the author of The Power of Habit, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I've been always amazed at how cheery the clerks at Starbucks are, and I also think that's true at Trader Joe's. And you say it's not just that they hire for cheerfulness, but also that they inculcate a habit of being cheery. How do they do that?
That's absolutely right. You know, Starbucks actually hires so many people that they can't just hire cheery people, right? And a lot of people that they hire are high school students or recent high school graduates, people for whom this is their first professional experience. What Starbucks does is they teach willpower habits. They're very, very strategic in trying to teach people how to marshal their willpower to make it through a tough moment at work. And one of my favorites, and you learn this in your first week at Starbucks, is you learn something called the latte habit. And the latte habit is something that your manager tells you if an upset customer comes in, that's your cue. And the routine is that you latte them. You listen to their complaint. You acknowledge their complaint. You thank them for complaining. You take care of their complaint by giving them like a free cup of coffee, and you explain why this will never happen again. And the reward is that this previously irate customer is now like overjoyed. And if you think about it, that's a really powerful thing to teach a 19-year-old working at Starbucks.
Go through that again slowly. We'll go through those steps. That's really interesting. Go do it again.
Sure, sure. It's you listen to their complaint. You acknowledge their complaint. You thank them for complaining. You take care of their complaint by giving them a free cup of coffee. And you explain why this will never happen again.
Love it. Love it. I could just see that work.
It's not that these steps are magical, right? They spell latte because you work at Starbucks.
Right,
easy to remember latte.
Right.
But what matters is that when someone comes up and they're upset with you, that you have a plan. Instead of getting defensive, instead of getting scared, You have a plan of what to do, and that makes you feel in control.
Love it. You say that like all organizations have these unspoken habits, not those that are explicit, like the latte technique for dealing with irate customers. They have unspoken habits, good and bad. Give me an example of an unspoken habit that an organization has that's a good habit.
Oh, I think that there's lots of them, right? I mean, I think that any time a good organization, whenever someone does something that might be, that the organization wants to applaud, but maybe isn't an obvious success, good leaders send out emails saying, mm-hmm. Hey, I just want everyone to know, Ryan and Beth just sent out a great report, and we didn't get the account, but that pitch was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a habit, right? That you get into this pattern where people begin complimenting each other on work that they do.
Great example.
Another great habit for many good organizations is this kind of ability to be honest with each other without people getting offended.
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of a colleague of mine, Adam Bryant, is releasing a book called Quick and Nimble.
He's my guest next week on the show.
Oh, he's great. Adam's fantastic. And a big part of that is talking about the ability to have honest, critical conversations without people getting upset.
Yep. Jack Welch was a guest on my show, and he said that was the key to his... Everybody talked about Neutron Jack and firing, but he said what he thinks is maybe the key to his success at GE was the fact that he created a culture where honest feedback was encouraged and did not trigger the right to feel offended, et cetera, et cetera. Great point, I think.
And you have to reward people for and compliment them for not getting upset, right? When you say to someone, look, I think you messed up on this, and they say, okay, let me hear the criticism. You got to say, I just want you to know, I think you handled this really, really well, me giving you this feedback.
Mm, great. Love it. That's a couple of bad ones. What are some unspoken habits within organizations that are not so good?
Well, I think that this happens in when companies don't think about developing habits. In the book, The Power of Habit, there's a chapter about Rhode Island Hospital that had a lot of dysfunction because nobody had ever structured the habits there. And the nurses and the doctors had a huge amount of tension. And so as a result, nurses had these habits of how to communicate with each other to warn each other about bad doctors. And that became enormously dysfunctional because nobody ever felt like they had to confront an arrogant physician or a physician who was not being careful enough because they had these habits to communicate with each other and work around the problem. And as a result, in one situation that I detail, a surgery is done on the wrong side of someone's head,
right?
Because no one felt empowered to stand up and say, look, a mistake's happening here. That happens a lot with communication habits where people develop workarounds that are a temporary fix, but they still allow some situation to exist that can explode into a real catastrophe.
A wonderful example. Can you give us one more example of an institutional habit that is a negative one that just accrues unconsciously and can be devastating?
At NASA, there were a lot of problems with people not taking enough risks. Essentially, after the Challenger explosion, there was a long period when people would be too cautious.
Mm.
And in some respects, every bad habit has a good reason for existing, right? I mean, people had just died, and so everyone wanted to make sure that they never took needless risks again. But the problem was that NASA exists to be a risk-taking organization, and the way that they had to fix that was that they actually had to start applauding what they called good failures.
Right.
When a unmanned rocket would be on the pad and would blow up, mission control would actually start applauding for that because it means that people had tried and had failed, but they had made a noble effort at trying. That's an example of situations where good intentions can develop in bad habits, and the only way that you can fix it is by overcorrecting with new habits that celebrate what you want to have occur.
Love it. You hear all the time a boss say, oh, yes, I encourage risk-taking, but in reality, they do punish it. And I think that's encouraging good failure, not stupid risks, but, thought-through, reasonable risks, even if they fail. That sounds great. Let's go to the phones. Now we got a lot of lines lighted up. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Charles Duhigg, the author of The Power of Habit. What is your question or comment for him? Hi, it's you.
Hi. I'm Kathleen, and I want to thank the author for the very balanced approach. I like the idea of, and have learned from my own life, that the thought process is very much more important than the end result, and experimentation we can do. We can trust that we can experiment and learn from that. My own two situations had to do with, now I'm looking for part-time work in retirement. And I realized the reason for my procrastination had to do with the fact that work had dominated my life. And so as I looked for work, it was like, I want, I don't want, I want, I don't want. And so I had to find a way of promising myself that I would only work part-time and that I would find a job that I knew I could balance in terms of my other life priorities. And the weight loss situation, I think, for me, it doesn't mean it's for everyone, but for me, I took the emphasis off of weight loss and rather looked at how to have a healthy attitude in terms of exercise and feeling healthy. And so I let go of the idea of losing weight, and actually in that way I've maintained and lost weight. So anyway, just my learnings, and thanks for the show.
And thank you for the call. I'm sure, Charles, you know, because your book has been out a year. It just came out in paperback now, but it's been out in hardback and it's sold a zillion copies. You've probably gotten a number of letters of thank you. Is there, and I know you've written about a couple of them in the book, is there one thank you letter you got that might be instructive for all of our listeners you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, you know, actually the best ones are from people who say, and we know from scientific studies that this is real, who say, I have been struggling with this problem for 40 years, and I finally changed, mm-hmm. right? I've been an alcoholic for 23 years, and I went to AA, and I've been sober now for 94 days. Mm-hmm. And this is the most important thing, is that we know from studies that any habit can be changed. It doesn't matter how old you are or how ingrained that behavior is. It can change. There are people who have been alcoholics for decades who tomorrow will go to Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober. There are people who in their 60s who have been obese their entire life who tomorrow will start a diet and will lose 25 pounds. And that's really important because I think particularly in our culture, we tend to tell people that you can change when you're a teenager and in your 20s, and then pretty much after that, it's not going to happen. Old dogs can't learn new tricks. That's just not true. Every study shows that that's not true. In fact, what we know is that once you're older and you actually know what you like and what you don't like, what rewards matter to you, you're in actually a better position to create real lasting change.
Your book devotes a nice section to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what, other than what we've already talked about, what is a lesson that is, what is something that Alcoholics Anonymous does with its 12-step program that does facilitate such kind of change even in older people?
Well, the most important things that AA does is that it puts you in a group setting, right? Change is much easier to accomplish when you're in the presence of at least one other person who's trying to change.
Is that true for everybody or only somebody? Some people.
What's that?
Is that true for everybody or just some people? Some people are kind of solo actors, it seems, and some others do better in a group.
There's no study. Every study finds that everyone benefits from a social experience.
Interesting.
And what's interesting is it doesn't have to be a big social experience. In fact, the number one determinant for whether someone will succeed in Alcoholics Anonymous is whether they know one other person who is in or has recently gone through AA.
Hmm.
Just knowing one other person makes a huge difference. And it's not having a big family that's supporting you and clapping you on the back. It's having one person who's been where you are. There's something about this group commitment where not only are you getting positive feedback from others who are saying, good job, we're really glad you've made it to 15 meetings, but it's also that you're sitting in this room and you look across the room and you see Jim, and Jim's been sober for 2 years, and Jim is kind of an idiot. And you think to yourself, look, if Jim can do it, I can definitely do it because I'm smarter than that guy. There's something about social experiences that makes change easier. And the number one thing people can do if they really want to change is find other people who are walking the same journey and figure out a way to talk to them regularly.
Anything else in AA that you think is another good key to change that we haven't yet discussed?
Well, there's a really interesting field of study around AA that has to do with belief. You know, AA, that one of the 12 steps, the 12 steps were not developed by scientists. They were
right.
essentially developed by amateurs. And there's this big emphasis on believing in a higher power.
Right.
And people have been very dismissive of that. Mm-hmm. But it seems important to people who are in AA. And the reason why it seems like from studies is that it's because when you learn to believe in a higher power, you're really practicing just believing, period. And eventually that allows you to believe in yourself. You know, most people, even if they intellectually think I can change, emotionally it might be a different story. And learning to believe, practicing belief, like any other habit or like any other skill, practicing belief allows you to get better at it and eventually believe that you can change if that's been a stumbling block for you.
My colleague, Dr. Michael Edelstein, who's a cognitive therapist, he thinks that people do fall on a continuum between people who do, you know, have a strong external, extrinsic motivational sense and a belief in God, and all those 10 people tend to do the best in 12-step programs. Those who are more rationally oriented tend to do better with cognitive behavioral therapy. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think cognitive behavioral therapy and AA are very, very similar, right? And sort of they're basically both trying to reprogram some dysfunctional habits in people's lives. And I think that oftentimes people, when they hear belief in a higher power or God, their brain kind of shuts off and they say, "I that's not me. Mm-hmm. I can't do that. I need a scientific explanation." But cognitive behavioral therapy and the 12-step programs, they actually say very, very similar things. They just put it in relatively different language. And the underlying principle is, look, like, if you diagnose why you're behaving the way that you're behaving, and if you accept that, like, there is this ability to change, it's really a kind of mechanical problem of figuring out how change happens for you. But to see those mechanics, to really believe that those mechanics are real, usually it involves letting go of this fear that you have, letting go of this egoism that you have, that you're different and that you can't change. And then being comfortable with these small steps towards progress and the failures that are inevitable and learning from them.
Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Charles Duhigg, the author of The Power of Habit. What's your question or comment for him?
Hi, I have a question. I have a low frustration tolerance. Well, so when things get tough, I tend to do something else or procrastinate right at the time when I need to bear down and try harder, and I was wondering how I could develop habits to deal with a frustration tolerance level.
Absolutely. That's a great question. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a field of study called implementation intentions that looks exactly at this problem. And what they found is the nice thing is that you know what sets you off, right? You know that you have a low tolerance for frustrations. So the thing you need to do is you need to sit down and figure out when does that trigger occur, and what's the number one first thing you're going to do as soon as it does, right? In a cold state right now, when you're not frustrated, when you're not upset, figure out what's the first thing you should do when you feel yourself getting frustrated that's going to help diffuse the situation. If you try and make that decision in the heat of the moment, it's not going to work, right? You know that once you get set off, you're not going to be able to change the pattern. But if you decide ahead of time on a plan for what you're going to do, and you write it down on a piece of paper and you post it on your cubicle or your desk so you see it, it's going to help you when you feel that frustration mounting. Just look at that piece of paper and do exactly what it tells you to do.
Okay.
So, and that doesn't mean that every single time it's going to be easy, but I promise you, by the eighth or ninth time, it's going to feel kind of automatic.
So, dear caller, let's test that out on you. Right now, we call that the moment of truth. There is a moment of truth when you're reaching something that's hard and you know you should be bearing down, but you're tempted to go get a burrito. That's the moment of truth. What is the thing that you could write down in advance as the prepared response for that desire to escape the uncomfortable and become comfortable with the burrito, literally or metaphorically?
Yeah, I think somehow telling myself that getting the task done or trying to get the task done is going to be a larger reward than the burrito. And if I don't get the task done or if I give up, there's actually going to be a negative reward.
So make it even more concrete. What's literally you feel that sense of frustration. What's the first thing you're going to do?
I would say stop focusing on it and maybe get a cup of coffee or search the web, you know, something like that, instead of continuing to work with the problem I'm having.
Okay, that's great. So let's say get a cup of coffee, right? Because that's a pretty fast thing. You get up from your desk. It gives you a chance to catch your breath. What's the second thing you're going to do? You get that cup of coffee. You're back at your desk. What are you going to do when you sit down at your desk that's going to help you push through where you normally sort of fall off the path?
Yeah, I don't know. That's the tough part. I think if there was somehow to divide the step into the problem into smaller steps, or to maybe try to call a colleague for help, or just trying to have a positive attitude to keep going, to keep focus on the problem instead of a negative attitude or a procrastination, just kind of this automatic reflex where procrastination
right.
kicks in.
Those are great. So I heard you just say three things, right? Number one is you could call a colleague. Number two is you could sort of try and like write down two positive things about why this isn't a frustration, why this is like a minor little setback, but you're going to overcome it. And the third thing you said is sort of just cut, like write down really quickly kind of something you can do to solve the problem. Now, I don't think you should do all three of those every single time. I think that you should have that list and you have those three things. And after you come back with your cup of coffee, try one of them. And then 10 minutes later, figure out, did it work for me? Like, I called a colleague. Did that make the situation better? When I came back from my cup of coffee, I sat down and I wrote two reasons why this isn't something that should make me upset, why this isn't a big setback, two reasons why I should be positive. 10 minutes later, figure out, did that help me? Did that help me move through it? The key is that the more concrete you get with your list of instructions to yourself, the easier it's going to be for you in the heat of the moment to follow them. And I don't know that you're going to come up with exactly the right set of instructions the first time you're thinking about it, but if you come up with a couple of options and you see how they work and you let yourself experiment, I guarantee you in 2 weeks you're going to have some type of solution that feels right to you and that's based on your experience.
I want to try to reframe that just a bit. I want you to think of it, I'm not disagreeing at all with what Charles is saying, but I want you to think of it as a toolkit. You know, a toolkit that's there for when that problem occurs. He's given a few examples. I'm going to add another one, by the way, which is how could you make it fun? Because right now you're tempted to escape to something fun. There sometimes is a way to think of it as fun, like, okay, this is a problem. Like if I'm doing the jumble in the newspaper, it's a problem, it requires thinking. Instead of thinking this, oh, it's hard, I'm going to escape it, can I make this fun? Can I break it down to baby steps? Should I call to get help? What could you know, having that toolkit available, as Charles was saying, in advance, so that when you know you reach the inevitable time, when you're reaching that challenging part, you don't have to, as Charles said, on the fly thing or something. You've got that toolkit and you can pull out, again, as Charles said, the one item from the toolkit that is most applicable to that situation. How's that feel?
Yeah, that's good. I think also kind of reframing it and looking at it as a puzzle, maybe instead of something
right.
to dread, looking at it as a challenge or a puzzle or something to try to solve instead of something to fear.
Exactly. I want to thank you very much for the call. We're going to go back to the phones, but I have so many questions. First of all, Charles, I want to thank you for staying with me for the whole hour. I normally keep my guests on a half hour, but I'm loving you, and so I hope you don't mind my having kept you on for a
while. No, I probably have to jump in about 2 minutes, unfortunately.
Got it.
My kids have a birthday party today.
Got it. And it's amazing. Yes, we prioritize the kids over even work. So I guess I'll ask you one last question. And that is, okay, I'm just going to ask you the generic softball question. I want you to think back on everything you've said, and is there any one or two points you have not yet made that you think would be more effective in helping us who are, you know, notorious for creating resolutions that that are long forgotten about or failed at by the end of the month? Any other point or two you want to make that's new or that you want to emphasize?
I think the biggest point that I can make is this. You know, we have this myth in America for New Year's resolutions that you sit down on December 31st, you come up with five resolutions, and then you try and make them work on January 1st. And everything we know about change suggests that's not actually how it happens, right? What actually happens is that we come up with some goals and we come up with baby steps and we reassess 2 weeks later and we see how it's going. And by the time you hit like March or April, things are actually really changing. But in the meantime, it's because you've made all these baby steps. Don't rush into like some huge change and then feel bad about yourself when on January 10th you're back to eating your old diet. Mm-hmm. Instead, sit down and say, okay, over the next month, I'm going to give myself permission to read a book like The Power of Habit or something else that helps me understand what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to take a month to write down five or six plans. and I'm going to try each plan for a week, and I recognize some of them are going to work and some of them aren't. And by the time I get to February 15th, I'm going to know a little bit more about what actually is going to change my life. And by July 1st, I'm going to have lost 15 pounds. But that's the point, is that you give your change happens in small incremental doses. And people get discouraged when it doesn't happen quickly. But if you've been carrying around extra weight, if you've been procrastinating for 5 or 10 years, an extra couple of months isn't going to kill you if that's a period when you're actually learning something about yourself and preparing to make a change that's going to last a decade.
I just realized there's some one thing I can't let you go. It's a fascinating part of your book that is about the fact that companies are always trying to get us as consumers to develop new habits. For example, to replace that perfectly nice green clothing with orange clothing that season. Can you give me an example of how companies try to manipulate us into developing a new habit so that we can do a better job of resisting their attempts to manipulate us?
Well, most of what they do is they try and study our existing habits and take advantage of them, right? They know that in the book we describe this story about Target sort of knowing when customers are pregnant based on how their shopping habits exist. Or they know that, you know, when it comes to February, if you're the type of person who, bought a new swimsuit last summer, that you're going to want a diet book in February. The key is, it's not necessarily terrible. Companies don't have, like, mind control abilities. They're trying to nudge us in certain ways. And if you're aware of those nudges, if you're making deliberate choices instead of just kind of going on autopilot, then they can be helpful or you can ignore them. The key is just to know, when companies send you something in the mail, when they try and lay out a store in a specific way, it's not by accident. It's because they want to encourage you to buy something in particular, and let that be a choice that you make instead of an automatic reaction.
Well, you have certainly encouraged us to consider a whole wonderful panoply of great suggestions for developing and keeping new habits. Charles Duhigg, thanks so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. Appreciate it a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. The book, The Power of Habits, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. He had to go, or I would have been happy to have the. We have callers on the line. Let's do what we can to fill the space. Maybe I can be of some help. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, it's you. Are you there? Let's go to the next line. We go to the next line? That way, okay. All right. Let me. You know, we've only got about 2 minutes left or 3 minutes left. What I wanted to do was that I have toward year end. I tweet a lot, and every time I get an idea that I think is fresh and important and can be stated in 140 characters, I try to do that. So let me end today's show with some of the tweets that are. Relevant particularly for the new year. I want to start with a bit of optimism. It is very easy, whenever we watch the news, there's always something negative, whether it be about the job market or how bad employers are treating employees or just, you know, how terrible things are going to be when we legalize marijuana because we're going to have an ever more memory-impaired workforce and a motivational workforce. But I really believe, and I find a great deal of solace in this, that with 7 billion people on the planet, all of us trying in our own way to make things better, how can one not be an optimist about the world's future? That's very comforting to me. And I'm more on the micro level, just almost a way of summarizing what Charles is saying. And as corny as it is and basic as it is, when we feel overwhelmed by anything, whether it be a task or life, you got to do some needed planning, but to try to stop thinking ahead, but staying in the moment, just simply putting that one foot in front of the other, that one second task after one second task. And finally, it's just, you know, this show, because it focuses on work, tends to be so focused on the practical and nuts and bolts. Amid the maelstrom, please don't forget about beauty, about art, about music. I'm looking at at David LaTulipe, a wonderful flutist who's going to be soloing at the Kensington Symphony Orchestra coming up. And I think about him and the joy he gives to everybody who hears and to himself and to his own life. And I think about literature and I think about theater, which I love. I think about not flashy movies like Ethan Coen movies that I love, Coen Brothers movies. And I think about charitable giving. And I think about that amid this maelstrom of efficiency, which nobody tries to be more efficient than I, but please don't forget about beauty. it is cruelly important to the life well led. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, David Latulippe, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And as I said to my guest will be Adam Bryant, New York Times writer and author of Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemco's some 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you can also email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com. That's Marty, N-E-M-K-O.com. Join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco here on 91.7 FM KALW San Francisco.